there might be something that the government could do to kind of incentivize students or incentivize our post-secondary education to focus more on fields that provides higher yield and align better with labor market needs. For example, they can align their allocation of fundings, because right now the provincial funding for universities and colleges, a lot of it is based on enrollment, right? Enrollment numbers. And I'm sure you know that in SFU, a lot of students are enrolled in these big programs like social sciences or business or like humanities, so on and so forth, right? So a lot of the funding is based on enrollment numbers. So if you have a bigger enrollment in this program or in this study, then we'll give you allocate you with more funds, because I mean, it's kind of intuitive. You need, because of the student base that you have, you need more money to operate, right? So operate fundings rely a lot on enrollment. But what we're suggesting is that maybe we can tie some of the transfers to performance metrics, such as, graduate enrollment, employment, or future earnings of their graduates, or at least like co-op participation. So when we reward these measurable outcomes for graduates, that kind of creates an incentive for the school and for the students to move into fields that we just talked about that has higher demand in the labor market.
Yeah, no, that's fair. Because you also mentioned in the article, you say our funding rewards volume, not alignment. So I'm now curious, like, do you think that there are certain social or cultural factors that kind of impact this? One of the things that comes to my mind is that for the past at least 2 decades, most people have been told you need a degree to succeed. And I wonder if that, in your mind at least, depresses some of the trades and enrollment.
No, definitely. I think you're right on spot there that cultural values from the students, from the demand side, also motivates the school to expand those programs that we just talked about. I mean, like there are a lot of people who love to study, more in social science and humanities, and that's, fair enough, because I understand. I major in economics, which is, part of the social science field, because it's more relatable, right? And like from like junior high school, a lot of your curriculum and a lot of your focus is on these fields, and so you feel like it's kind of natural to go into these fields, right? So that goes back to like the student demand side. How do we like kind of move the needle from the cultural side? How do we incentivize students to go into these technical applied roles in STEM, in healthcare, in skilled trades even? Because actually, when you look at the employment outcomes, the unemployment rate, the youth unemployment rate for age 15 to 24 year old, which is like the primary age group where you just fresh out of college and fresh out of university and you're trying to land your first job. The youth unemployment rate is so high in this year. It's 13.8% in 2025. And actually, for college graduates, that youth unemployment rate is actually lower than university new grads. And that is very rare. Like after you don't see that very often since the late 1990s, and that's a new trend after the pandemic. And part of it is because of what we talked about, the labor market shortage in skilled trades and in nurses and so on and so forth, right? So these applied roles and roles in STEM major are actually like having a hard time filling these roles, whereas you have social science, arts, and humanity major new grads who are just struggling to find their first job, right? So this mismatch is definitely partly can be contributed to cultural value or like drivers from the student demand side. So yeah, I think what you said is quite on point.
Yeah, and you mentioned there a little bit about this, recent university graduate unemployment rate and how it's ticked up. One of the things that I've seen in this current job market is that quite a lot of entry-level jobs are asking for 2 to 5 years of experience. And I'm kind of curious if you believe that that also has an impact on unemployment rates.
Oh yes, definitely. I mean, you've mentioned something like a catch 22, dilemma, whereas I'm fresh out of school, I want to land my first job. Meanwhile, all of these entry-level job requirements, they already require some job experience, right? Which I don't have. But if I don't have the job experience, how do I, land a job that can give me job experience, right? So partly that's because of a very heated job market right now, right? So the competition is very, very heated. And therefore, for entry-level jobs, there might be competitions from people with a little bit of experience already. And that's why the companies are slowly and steadily trying to raise their job requirement a little bit. So yeah, it's a tough job market as of now. It's a tough job market for university new grads, that's for sure.
And you kind of brought up something, people often call it degree inflation, which is this idea of, people requiring higher and higher levels of degrees, or people who have, a bachelor's degree taking jobs that are traditionally more for people who only have a high school diploma. In our current labor market, do you think that there's a way to deal with this form of underemployment?
I think you raise a very good question. For new grads that couldn't find a job, what do you do? The first option is to settle, which is what we called underemployment. So basically, you go into a position where the job requirement is actually lower than your actual qualification, right? Another way, another route is to go up into higher education. So basically, if I can't find a job now, I'll just go into the master's degree. And maybe in another 2 years or, 1 year, the job market will change and I have a better, education. So that's what you call the reason why we're seeing a degree inflation right now. I think for the current labor market, to resolve that's a complicated issue that has you have interplays from both sides, from the labor market side and from the labor demand side and from the supply side. And from the supply side, you have the student skill mismatch, which this op-ed was talking about. You have too many graduates from these low ROI majors or fields, whereas you have too few graduates from the high ROI or high labor demand majors. So you have this very weird mismatch when you have high unemployment and underemployment for some new grads, but in the meantime, jobs can't really fill their roles, right? Companies can't fill their roles in some fields. So that's from the demand side. From the supply side, it also, sorry, from the supply side, from the labor demand side, you have to look at the company and you have to look at the overall macroeconomic, fluctuations. As of now, people's like the investor confidence and the consumer confidence in our economy, Canadian economy, and global economy overall is very low, is very pessimistic, right? So investors are very cautious about investing in new fundings, and therefore the roles opening, new roles opening are very in short stock. So you have to look at it from both sides, and the conclusion is it is a tough job market for new grads, and the solution, I don't know. We can start, maybe start from trying to align the incentives, the funding incentives, to try to fill this skill gap.
Okay. No, that's fair. And because you brought that up, this idea of, aligning the funding incentives, I'm curious, how do you think it would work for the government to track employment post-graduation and issue funds for schools after that information has been gathered? Do you think that there might be a bit of a lag there, or yeah, are there any places where that's been done that you could kind of help point to?
Yes, definitely. I think it's definitely doable. It would require some fundamental systematic reform, but it's definitely doable. We now have the help of artificial intelligence and machine learning that helps you to track the most up-to-date high-frequency job postings data, which would give you a little bit of insight on how the job market is currently doing by different like fields and different sectors and occupations. So yeah, you're right. The data will be lagged, of course. But as of now, the majority, I would say 86%, I think around 86% of the provincial funding towards universities and colleges on average are based on historical levels, how much we give you last year, and enrollment numbers, right? And only 1 to 2% of that is performance-based. And we can change that, right? We can partly change that. That's the current structure. So even though that the job market data could be a little bit lagged, we still have access to some most up-to-date job postings data and enrollment data and graduate outcomes. And we can link that with the performance of the graduates and the performance of the school, link that to the funding structure. I think that's a good way to start. And in terms of current examples, I believe that some Atlantic provinces are already experimenting with, like they are like earmarking a lot of these funding to colleges and universities that's targeting healthcare. Because this is a very huge problem for Atlantic provinces, right? Because they have a aging population and their demand for healthcare, for nurses and for paramedics and so on and so forth are just, they're in dire demand, right? So what the government did is that they reacted to that challenge and they're like, okay, we're going to earmark this part of funding directly to colleges and applied colleges and polytechnics that are like producing or training graduates in these fields, right? I think that's an experiment that every province, provincial government should just take a look at and research into the eligibility and like if it's doable in your province. And you know, we could start from there.
No, that's really great because I was thinking about vocational schools, and it sounds like that's kind of where you think this kind of educational system should be leaning more towards. So I'm wondering, do you think that like the unemployment, the ongoing youth unemployment and future labor needs could be best addressed by having more of this specific job training and sector training?
Yes, I think partly that could be the area that we can work on. For starters, the current colleges and polytechnics who are responsible for mostly taking the role of training these applied talent, like talents with applied skills, they're receiving much less per capita funding from the provincial government than their university peers. And if you think about it, a lot of these school programs, like STEM, construction, trades, healthcare, applied healthcare programs, they actually have a higher program on average program costs than a lot of these university programs because a lot of these university programs are lecture based. And you don't, like for these applied skill training programs, you need like labs and special equipment and for nurses, you have to have these placement, right? You have the designated placements. So that's a lot of investment. That's a lot of cost to train a skilled tradesperson, to train a nurse, right? So compare the cost with the funding that they're getting. No wonder that we're having a labor shortage, chronic labor shortage in skilled trades and nurses, right? So you're right. The weight and the funding allocation is currently putting colleges and polytechnics into a very weak position, whereas their role in solving this skill gap, this skill mismatch issue is critical.
Well, Well, Shi, I want to thank you so much for your time. I think that this is going to be really informative for all of our viewers and listeners. Just thank you again.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's nice to talk with you, Matthew.
Awesome. This is Matthew on CJSF Radio 90.1 FM.
All I can get is static or variations on the central musical rhythm.
I only wish there was some way we could tell it to shut up. It's driving me crazy. Keeps getting louder.
We have no way of estimating the volume this creature can produce.
The only logical solution is to listen to CJSF 90.1 FM. They broadcast from Burnaby Mountain in British Columbia. Let's tune in now.
Yeah. Dr. Anthony Lizewitz, and this is Climate Connections. To get around the Phoenix, Arizona area, people often need to drive on highways and wide roads that cut through sprawling developments. But now the real estate company Cul-de-Sac is building a new kind of neighborhood in the suburb of Tempe, which is designed specifically for car-free living. Cul-de-Sac Tempe has apartments, shops, and restaurants all connected by sidewalks and plazas where people can walk and bike. There are no parking spots for residents, but they do get an unlimited pass on Tempe's light rail, which has a station nearby. And residents can rent cars for longer trips. Ryan Johnson, the company's co-founder and CEO, says the development is about half finished, but already over 300 people have moved in.
And it's the kind of neighborhood that millions of Americans want to live in.
He says living in walkable areas helps people connect with one another.
We have one resident with a family that says they've met more people living in 6 months in Cul-de-Sac than 15 years living in the suburbs.
And the neighborhood helps residents cut their planet warming carbon pollution because they no longer need to drive. So Johnson hopes other cities will follow Cul-de-Sac Tempe's lead and build more walkable, car-free neighborhoods of their own. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
We're from the Kiwassa Preteen Spring Camp. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. Campus Community Radio from Simon Fraser University on Burnaby Mountain.
This is a CHY News Update. Growing up, poetry was not something Jen Stroob connected with very much. But after figuring out how poetry could be a tool to express herself, she now wants to help other youth find the same connection. Taking over the role from Paige Pierce, Stroob is the City of Nanaimo's newest Youth Poet Laureate. Starting her two-year term this month, Stroob will work to connect youth in the community with poetry and raise awareness of the positive impact the literary arts can have. Stroob spoke with CHY as she sets out to start in her new role. Stroob says she wasn't much of a writer or reader growing up, finding it difficult to finish a book or novel study in high school. As the COVID-19 pandemic slowed things down for everyone, Stroob says she discovered the book series After by Anna Todd, which helped her fall in love with reading.
And I continued to do online courses, online school through COVID, and I found all of my written responses to homework being very, I don't know, more existential, if you will. So I just started writing in my free time, and yeah, poetry didn't come until much later, but writing was definitely there. Reading was definitely there. Start working at a bookstore. All of it's there.
Soon, Stroob turned her psychology major into a psychology and creative writing double major, which she is now in her third year of. In her studies, she has learned new writing techniques and how she can use poetry as a new way to express herself.
Sometimes it's really difficult to put a feeling into words that make sense to someone else, or like a lesson, something learned, whereas poetry allows you to be very... You can do whatever you want, really. Sometimes there's no rules. I really like writing in free verse for that reason. And it definitely gets everything that I'm feeling out onto the page without rules or stipulations.
Growing up as a child faced with many challenges as her parents went through a messy divorce, Stroob says it was her childhood psychologist who inspired her to go into psychology so she could be that person for other children who go through similar experiences.
And then I watched as Paige, the Youth Poet Laureate before me, had this effect on people and how inspired they were by her. And I kind of wanted to take that same thing that I was manifesting into psychology and put it into the same pursuits like poetry, creative writing, and do the same. So yeah, and then I was going through the application process and filling out my application, and I had so many ideas for things to do, and I was like, yeah, I want to do this.
With her newfound passion for writing and poetry, Stroob was encouraged by her friends to apply for the role. So she took a chance and got it. Looking back, Stroob says she wished she had the tools of poetry to help express herself when she was growing up. As Nanaimo's new Youth Poet Laureate, she says now it's her turn to help the youth in the community.
It's a fantastic way to express yourself, and especially if you know you're more existential than others and you're like, no one gets me, no one understands me, they're not in my head, they don't get it. writing a poem about the way that you feel, still people might not get you, but, you know, it's a way to express yourself that's not in a, you know, sentence with commas and periods that is supposed to make sense. It's a form of expression in itself. So I think it's really important to have that freedom and that outlet.
Stroob says she's excited to start her role and meet more people in Nanaimo's poetry community, and already has many ideas for what's to come in this new position. This is Jen Stroob reading one of her latest pieces of work.
Okay, it's called Chronological, and it's in chronological order what I wanted to be when I grew up. A princess, a teacher, just a girl, pretty, smaller, the winner of The Voice, an artist, firefighter by day, pop star by night, horse trainer, flight attendant, Tinkerbell, brave, pilot, musician, famous, compared to a shot of espresso, 7 of 9, rich enough to afford plastic surgery, rich enough to give to the homeless, skinny, warm, cold, hot, nice, kind, beautiful, honest, little, pocket-sized, big foot, but not with big feet, Mother Nature, like you, like them, strong enough to beat the crap out of whoever invented the beep test, Alex Russo, noticed, popular, curvy, but not fat, his friend, his girlfriend, touchable, untouchable, close to him, far from him, Medusa, Rachel Green, a beam of sunlight, medicated, healthy, astronaut, Stevie Nicks in her famous 1997 performance of Silver Springs, a writer, a florist, a painter, a designer, a mother, someone worth remembering, someone who could do pottery, a sharp, sharp knife, a cowgirl, digital, an oil painting in a museum, skinnier than that, to look like other girls, a therapist, an author, just me, the way I am.
For CHY News, this is Laura McKenzie.
This report was made with the support of the Local Journalism Initiative, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and listeners like you. You can find more news updates, interviews, and stories from our nonprofit newsroom, as well as our news and current affairs podcast, Midcoast Morning, at chly.ca/news.